You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
I do think Chicago's a different market. You need a rare bird to me to play the position there. You do have to be mentally tough. You got to be able to be Teflon. I say that all the time because it's in your face all the time. There's a lot of scrutiny. There's a lot of passion. And you got to be up for that challenge. And I do think that you got to be prepared for it. You can be mentally tough. And you can prepare yourself and build mental toughness to deal with all the onslaught that's going to come your way.
Zach Zaidman and Tom Thayer on 670 The Score, a radio.com sports station.
The man that you heard entering this segment, former Bears quarterback Jim Miller with Mully and Haw last week on Chicago's sports radio 670 The Score. And he knows from experience it's not easy to play quarterback. It is definitely not easy to play quarterback as a Bear in this market. But I would submit that it is possible if you're talented and you're good at what you do, then all that media pressure is not the same. For example, I don't think, Tom, that when you were playing with Jim McMahon, that he was ever worried about the crush of cameras and microphones in front of him. Because he knew he was good. Now, obviously, he had injury issues, which prevented him from fulfilling his complete potential as an NFL player with the Bears. But I don't think it was the media crush that prevented him from doing that. He knew he was good.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the pressure of football didn't get to Jim McMahon because Jim McMahon understood the game. He was bred for this in the college program that he succeeded in. It was probably a more diverse offense than he was coming to in Chicago. Jim's a super confident guy in his own ability. Like you mentioned, there were some health issues that he faced throughout his time here. But it was never the academic side of football that intimidated him. If anything, he flourished in it, and he wanted to do more because of his background. And it's the unique trait of Jim McMahon, but he also was inside of a locker room that had a lot of confident guys in that locker room. From every single position out there, there was a position that was going to walk in that room as equally chest puffed out as Jim McMahon could. So I do think it was the perfect matchup between different personnel groupings and Jim as the quarterback.
Right. That's why I just shake my head. And I've been around a lot of these quarterbacks that have not done well over the years at Soldier Field and Hallis Hall. Rex Grossman did not bust out with the Bears because he was worried about the media attention. The reason that he was never able to fulfill his complete potential with the Bears is he was an inconsistent practice player. And that's what he was on game day, an inconsistent player. There was good Rex and there was bad Rex. The reason that Jay Cutler didn't max out as a Bear isn't because of the media crush. It was because he was an inconsistent player on game day. You never quite knew what you were going to get. It had nothing to do with the crush of cameras and microphones. The reason that Mitchell Trubisky has been up and down in his Bears career is not because of the pressure of being Bears quarterback. It's because there are issues in terms of his ability as a quarterback. Mike Glennon had issues because he was not a good quarterback, not because of the media. And I think it's easy to blame the media for things, but I'll give you a great example. How many Cubs teams did they say, oh, man, this is so difficult. You know, they play all these day games at home and then they play the night games on the road, and then they have these, you know, they always have to answer questions as soon as they get into it about being the next team to be able to extinguish the curse. Well, you know what? The 2016 team was able to do that, and they didn't make excuses. It's because they were good. I think the rest of it is all excuses. And I think in sports, what you learn is if you give yourself an opportunity to make an excuse, more often than not, players are going to take that opportunity to use the excuse. And I bring that up because, you know, when you look at football, all sports really, during this 2020 climate that we're going to be living in, where, you know, it's going to be hard to get yourself properly energized and motivated without fans in the stands. You can't use the excuses of what's different in 2020 because you will fail if you start thinking about what isn't there that usually is.
Yeah. You know, one thing when you look at the Cubs and their success, you look at the leadership role at that time. Joe Madden, he changed the culture around here. And he took some veterans and he grew their experience inside that locker room. But then he took a lot of young guys on the cusp of being really talented guys and continue to cultivate their talents. And he led that team as one singular unit to accomplish what they're able to accomplish. So I think Joe Madden had such an important role in the success of the Cubs organization. Now, when you're talking about the quarterback position, you know, the quarterback position is probably a little bit better to evaluate your true understanding of the offense. Because when you talk about Rex Grossman, you talk about Jay Cutler, you talk about Mike Glennon, you saw some of the inadequacies in a guy like Mike Glennon. But when you have Jay and you have Rex Grossman, you know, those guys were around for a while and they were in the same offense. And you kind of hope that they would develop some consistencies in their game because they're hearing the same information, the same terminology. So now let's talk about Rex Grossman, about Mitchell Trubisky. Because now this Mitchell Trubisky, I've always had patience for the development of the quarterback position, and I still have that patience with Mitchell Trubisky, and that's why I believe the best is yet to come. But so when you're a coaching staff and you put together a practice plan, you can put together every single play that you know for a quarterback how it's going to start and how it's supposed to finish and how it's supposed to finish in the perfect time frame. So if you have inconsistencies in that time and time again, you're learning something about that player. Either he's not studying enough or he doesn't have the vision built within him to play quarterback at an NFL level. Because we talked about those throws Mitch is repetitiously doing. You got to be able to make that throw with your eyes closed and get it into the area. But because of these coaches, John DeFilippo and Bill Lazor and Dave Ragone and Matt Nagy, they're reading their script and they're saying, okay, blah, 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 and they know what defense they're going to see. They know exactly what's supposed to happen already. So now they have to see how the quarterback acts and reacts, and that's going to ultimately tell the story of the battle between Mitch and Nick.
That's Tom Thayer. I'm Zach Zaidman. We are broadcasting live from the Hyundai Studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. Coming up in about 20 minutes, we will talk with Tom's former teammate on the 85 Bears, one of the best to ever do it, Hall of Fame left tackle Jimbo Covert. Also, we will talk with the Coom Dog around 2 o'clock. There's a lot going on in baseball, so we'll shift gears to baseball at 2 o'clock and spend the entire hour with the Coom Dog and break everything down.
But hey, I have a golf-related question to baseball for Coom Dogs.
Really?
I sit there and I watch this stuff, and then all of a sudden I think, man, I need to talk to Ron right now. But now I got to wait. I always have to wait till the weekend, so.
Well, you're going to have that opportunity. Also, a special edition on Friday, this upcoming Friday, July 3rd, the three of us, the Coom Dog, you, Tom, me, we're going to be filling in on Chicago's number one morning sports radio show, Mully and Haw, here on The Score. So we will be on the air, the three of us together, from 5 to 9 on Friday morning. So it'll be a special treat for everyone. You know, obviously we're not Mullion Haw, but we hope it's the next best option on Friday morning. Speaking of quarterbacks, did you hear about Jay Cutler? This is right up your alley. You're going to love this. So he recently joined Instagram. You know, Tom, that's one of those social media platforms. And he posted his first story last Wednesday. He announced to his 480,000 plus followers at the time, quote, "There is a chicken serial killer on the loose," unquote, at his farm in Nashville. He said many of his chickens died and he would set up a hidden camera so they could investigate who was responsible for the terrible crimes. And he mentioned some of the possibilities, a coyote, a bobcat, a raccoon. You know, I'm a city kid, so these are all foreign things to me. He said it could be anything. And then he kind of zeroed in on his pet cat named Thelma. Jay has a pet cat named Thelma, and he said, "I hope you don't show up on camera tonight." And he set up the cameras and everything, including night vision goggles. I mean, he was ready to go, and he started the hunt for the chicken serial killer. I feel like there are a lot of different ways a player can go in retirement, and it's just beyond belief to think that just a few years ago, he was ready to do what you do, which is analyze football games for a living. He was going to do that on TV. Then the Dolphins called, gave him $10 million more. And now Jay is like, I don't even recognize who this guy is anymore.
So for over 400,000 people worry about who's getting Jay's chickens. And, you know, hey, I, you know, listen, man. I always thought that the interviews that you did with Jay Cutler after the games were some of the most professional interviews I've ever heard anybody do. He's a well-spoken guy, and he spoke truthfully to you. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of the relationship that you forged with him. So, you know, I don't dislike Jay Cutler the person. I'm a Bears fan who was disappointed in the results, because when I remember that the day they went and made the trade for Jay Cutler, I was thinking, wow, you know, this is possibly a franchise quarterback that we have coming to the Bears, and you know, we just didn't we didn't get what we all hoped for.
Yeah, it was an era that left us unfulfilled, you know, because so much was expected, and you think about it. The first year he came here, I just think there was a clash in terms of the offense that the Bears were running, and he knew that he would ultimately have the say when all was said and done because he had the long-term security. So they ended up switching the offense a year after he got here. They signed Julius Peppers as a free agent, and the Bears had, again, one of the best defenses in football over the next 3 years after his first season with the team, and that included the year they went to the NFC Championship game, then he gets hurt in that game against the Packers. So they lose that game. The next year, which may have been the best year I think he had as a quarterback with the Bears, they're off to a 7-3 start. I mean, they are humming. Everything is going right. You know, but he breaks his thumb in that game against the Chargers. And all the Bears needed was one more win than they ended up getting, and they couldn't pick up that victory. So they don't make the playoffs, but Cutler likely would have been ready to go come playoff time. He was working his tail off to come back, doing everything possible in terms of the rehab, but it was not to be. The next year, they win 10 games, and what happens? They don't make the playoffs, and Lovie Smith gets fired, and the Bears have been trying to build their way back up. You wonder if he would have meshed well with the current group that they've got. You know, I understand what they did when they let him go and they drafted Mitchell Trubisky, but they didn't have Khalil Mack back then. He wasn't available. They make the trade for Khalil Mack. It totally changes the Bears as we know them. And you wonder if he'd be a better option for what they've, not now, obviously, he's retired, but the type of quarterback he was when he was good here, if that would have worked better with the kind of defense they have. But it's not going to help you solve anything in 2020.
No, again, it goes back to the root of all evil. It's the study habits of the quarterback. One thing about Jay, he had all the arm talent that's ever been through the NFL. If he was in a skills contest, he would go toe-to-toe with any of them. But that's just such a small percentage of what it takes to be a successful quarterback. And, you know, from four interceptions at Green Bay to some of the other disappointing moments that he failed to capture the attention or, you know, the fan appreciation. And, you know, so, I mean, he's got a great opportunity to live on Instagram now. But I think when you listen to the Bears fans and season ticket holders, and they want to accomplish what Joe Madden helped the Cubs accomplish when he led them to a World Series.
All right, so you brought up a really good point there. You were talking about how it's more than just the physical traits of a quarterback that lead to success. And I think, you know, when it comes to Mitchell Trubisky, that's kind of what the coaching staff is looking to see. Those other traits show up in this quarterback competition with Nick Foles. How do you go about testing that in what will be as different of a training camp as we've ever had because of the climate that we're living in? And who knows if the preseason schedule gets reduced. You know, we've already seen the cancellation of the Hall of Fame game. If the preseason schedule doesn't give you the full complement of games, how do you go about making sure that you can trust Trubisky in the areas where you may have lost trust in him last season, which has led us to this quarterback competition?
You know, the thing about it is you could go out in the field and you can have a pass, punt, and kick competition between Mitchell Trubisky and Nick Foles. And so you're going to look at their arm strength that's going to be, you know, demonstrated to you, and you're going to have to learn those things about it. You could take both of those two players into a quarterback's room, and you could give them a test on it with a stopwatch. Okay, I'm going to read this play to you. I'm going to show you this defense. You give me – there's only one answer to the what that play is supposed to do. Yeah, you have three options, A, B, and C. But I want A option immediately out of your mouth. And so you can test the way that they're understanding the information they're absorbing. Because that's what you have to do, is you got to know this, all this information, second nature. You got to know it so well that you're not dwelling on the decision. The decision's made for you, but while you're calling the play and looking at the defense in front of you, you can learn those things about the quarterback position, unlike, you know, the test of strength that you have between offense and defensive linemen, open field tackling for a linebacker to a DB. Those are the types of things you have to test with those positions. Intelligence is the key ingredient to the success of quarterback position.
Yeah, but you know what? Even if Trubisky doesn't end up winning the job, you know, based on Nick Foles' injury history, even if Foles is the starting quarterback, history tells you that at some point during the year, they're going to need Trubisky to be a factor for them, and not just a quarterback that comes in there and keeps the seat warm, but a quarterback that helps you win. So his development throughout all of this is crucial.
Well, you want Mitchell Trubisky to be the next Steve Young. And I kind of harp on Steve Young a lot because we had a common journey together, and I watched him in the USFL, and he wasn't very good. And I watched our defensive coaches talk about preparing to play against him as an inexperienced quarterback out of BYU. Then I was with the Chicago Bears when he went to Tampa Bay, and I watched the same struggles that he had down there. And he looked like a quarterback that didn't deserve to be in the league. Then he went and got into the perfect scenario, learned behind Bill Walsh and Joe Montana. And then he took over for Joe Montana. It was like they didn't skip a beat. So that's what Mitchell Trubisky has to do. I know we talk about Nick Foles and the experiences he has, and he's more of the Joe Montana type, and Mitchell Trubisky is more the Steve Young type. And so that's what I still want to see with patience. And, again, having Steve Young in the back of my mind and how long it took for him to develop into the Hall of Fame quarterback he became, that's kind of why I have the patience for Trubisky.
See, now, that's another great point that you make, because it took the perfect marriage of Steve Young's skills combined with the right offense to take advantage of those skills. I don't know if this offense is the best offense for Mitchell Trubisky. And I don't know if he can ever reach that potential here. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but you get the feeling that you need to morph the offense a little bit more to say what's taking place in San Francisco or Tennessee, to play to the strengths of the quarterback's ability, the strengths of your team, in order to make it right.
You're talking about Tennessee and San Francisco. You're talking about two of the more dominant running games in the league, especially with Derrick Henry in Tennessee. I think David Montgomery is probably the most under-talked about weapon the Bears are going to have going forward. So if he has if he contributes to the offense like the running game at the end of the season in San Francisco or the running game throughout the season in Tennessee, that's going to help the quarterback play tremendously. If you go out there, though, and you have an ineffective, underappreciated running game, your opponent is not going to respect you. All they're going to do is attack your quarterback.
So if you look at what the Bears really focused on from an offensive standpoint over the course of the offseason, there was clearly a priority placed on fixing the tight end position and making sure you had guys that aren't just better than what you had, but available. Because availability was a big issue at the position last year. That's, I think, one of the reasons they spent big money on Jimmy Graham, because of the fact that he's been a durable player, even though he's an older player. And Cole Kmet comes in. They made him the top draft pick of the team. They clearly identified him as a need, and they brought in Demetrius Williams, another tight end who understands... Demetrius Harris, another tight end who understands the system. And that tells me they're running the same offense. They just need to run it better.
Right. All right. I don't disagree with you at all. I don't think the problem is in the offense. I don't think Matt Nagy is, you know, become some, you know, for, you know, going, you know, leading the offense he did the first year, then the second year. I just think it's a matter of, you know, taking the experiences of the past of Juan Castillo and Matt Nagy together and understand, again, the repetitive pounding of Juan Castillo at his press conference. He understands that there's going to be a physical style of a running team. You talk about the size of the three guys competing at offensive guard, and Rashad Coward and Jermaine Ifedi and Alex Bars. They're all 320-plus. They don't have a great deal of experience, but you want to turn that pounds into power. And I think that's when you look up and down the line of scrimmage from the weight room to the field, that's what the Bears need to do, is to have that respected physical running game that takes a little bit of pressure off. Mitch has got to be the quarterback has to be the best player on the offense for the offense to succeed. Now, the best part of your offense has to be the offensive line and the running back, and then they have to assist the quarterback and the receivers.
So where do the tight ends come in?
Plus territory, red zone, catches anywhere from the line of scrimmage to 6 yards down the field, immediate matchup threats between Cole Kmet and Jimmy Graham. You're not going to find two guys that can take themselves out of the interior of the defense and have a guy that can go shoulder to shoulder with Jimmy Graham. No. I don't know if you're going to be able to find a defender that's going to be able to go shoulder to shoulder in terms of height and coverage of Cole Kmet. And I think I like the program Cole Kmet came from, because there's a lot of pressure on those kids at Notre Dame that's put on you from Brian Kelly, the head coach. So it's not like Cole Komet's going to climb into a shell in case someone yells at him or corrects him harshly. He's faced that since he's been at Notre Dame. So when you look at the production of the tight end position, what they didn't get last year, there was no respect, there was no concern, there was no thought in the red zone. So that's what has to turn around the most for that position.
Tom, when we come back, we are going to talk to one of the few men on the planet who's been lucky enough to be fitted for a gold jacket in Canton, Ohio. Our guest, one of the best to ever do it for the Bears, next on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
When did you get the call?
Well, I'm actually out in San Francisco, so it was quite early I got the call this morning. Dave Baker gave me a call before it actually went on the air, so that was a good thing. I was on, when it first came on, I was on pins and needles. I said, I don't think you're going to announce anything. And then Dave Baker gave me a call, and it was pretty emotional. It was pretty awesome.
Zach Zaidman and Tom Thayer on 670 The Score, a radio.com sports station.
Tom, I don't know about you, but I don't think there's ever a bad time to get that call. Ever. It doesn't matter if you're in a deep sleep. It doesn't matter if it's 3 in the morning. It doesn't matter if it's 11:45 at night. If you're getting a call that you're going to be one of the few men on planet Earth that has ever had an opportunity to get fitted for a gold jacket, and you're going to have that bust in Canton, that is a big, big deal. And we are pleased to be joined by a man who's getting that honor, but he's had to be patient to get to this point, and now he's going to have to be patient one more year. Talking about 85 Bear Jimbo Covert, who joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Jimbo, thank you so much for spending some time with us. You know, it was Benjamin Franklin that said, he that can have patience can have what he will. So what's one more year, right?
Yeah, you know what? I think it's the right thing to do. I think a lot of guys were disappointed, with the result. But it's the right thing to do physically. You know, there's just a lot of things that are out there. If you think about it, people with underlying health conditions and the elderly, and the worst thing could happen is bringing your family and friends there to celebrate with you and someone gets ill. So I think it's the right thing to do. And I look at it a different way. I just say I have another year to celebrate. So that'll be a lot of fun.
I like it.
You know, Jimbo, it had to be exciting because when I've had a chance to see David Baker speak, he's one of the best speakers I've ever seen, and how much he cares about the Hall of Fame and how important the players are to him. When you got that call from him, was it, Jimbo, something that you deserve, something you've been waiting for a long time, but that instant of David Baker when he's on the other end of the phone and you know it's coming, it's not like the dean of students or someone calling you. I mean, this is it. What's it like when you hear his voice on the other end?
Well, to tell the truth, Tom, it was just when I first heard his voice, you know, it was 4:30 in the morning and I was up and I had some coffee and I kind of wasn't all the way awake. And then I thought maybe he was calling me that I didn't get in. You know, and calling guys that didn't get in. And I said, well, he wouldn't be doing that. And then he kind of got to the point real quick. So, I mean, it's tremendous feeling and honor. And then you just get so emotional. And like I said, I think your whole world, your whole life flashes before you like in a minute, you know. So you think about all the guys that you played with from high school and, you know, in college and all my teammates with the Bears. And then, you know, just your family and your parents and your wife and kids, and it gets pretty emotional. So when I first heard it at the beginning, it was a little confusing for me early in the morning, but I got it pretty quickly.
You know, it's amazing, as I had Zach look up, and I said, has there ever been roommates that are both in the Hall of Fame? And surprisingly enough, Jimbo, there is a couple. So your roommate in college, Dan Marino. So, you know, it's funny because the relationship between you two is, you're probably the most important offensive line position throughout his All-American, that which led to a Hall of Fame career in college. And I was always interested, the offense that you played in college, was it more developed than the offense that you played in initially when you came to the NFL? Because we were talking earlier about Jim McMahon and the offense he played in at BYU for Lavelle Edwards. And then you think of Jackie Sherrill, your head coach, Dan Marino, your quarterback, Joe Moore, your offensive line coach. That's some of the best in the business of football, no matter what level you're talking about. So initially, my question, was that offense a little bit more upscale than the pro offense you played in at first?
Oh, yeah. It was way more advanced, I think, because, you know, we used to throw the ball 35, 40 times a game. Of course, we had Dan Marino, so that made a big difference. And, you know, we used to run the ball as well, too. I mean, we had a guy, Brian Thomas, played in the USFL. He gained 1,000 yards. We had another guy, Dwayne DeBartolo. He's a fullback. He gained about 600 yards. So we had a good run and a good run offense and a good passing offense, but you know, we did so many things off of that allowed us to do great things running the ball and throwing the ball. It was a lot more advanced. But you know, when Ed Hughes was there with us, Tom, and then I think they let Jim do some things that maybe they didn't agree with right away, with audibling and things like that, because I think McMahon's the smartest guy I ever played with. I mean, he could do things it wasn't the greatest physically, but mentally, you know, I think he football smart. I think he was the smartest guy I ever played with.
Well, you and I went to the Hula Bowl together after our senior year in college. It's a college all-star game played in Hawaii. And you kind of get familiar with the guys that are day one starters. And you look at Bruce Matthews from the West Coast, and you look at you from the Midwest or the East Coast part, and two guys that are going to go on to have Hall of Fame careers. Did you put an enormous amount of pressure on yourself going in as a rookie, going, okay, if they're going to pick me this high, then I got to be prepared for that day one opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, I got there in minicamp my rookie year, and Mike Ditka said, the job is yours. And, you know, he expected me to perform at a high level. And so there was a lot of expectation around a first-round draft pick that high coming in and playing right away. I think maybe when you look at it, that's probably one of the hardest positions to come in and play as a rookie. Maybe quarterback's a little bit harder than that. So, you know, there were some adjustment problems at the beginning, especially with the offense. I know you know this as well, but when you get there, my whole career, you know, even from Pop Warner on, it was always, you know, even on the right and odd on the left, right? When I get to the Bears, it's completely opposite. So for the first, like, 5 weeks, I went the wrong way and tried to understand the offense, but it took a while, but I got it.
I remember our after practice at the Hula Bowl when you and I were going to try to take a couple laps in the Hawaii heat.
Yeah, we only made one lap, I think. That was about it.
Right.
But I think we were both about 300 pounds then, too.
Right. We all had to go in the scale and weigh in line of each other, and so we were there. Jimbo and I were both above 300 pounds, so we said, we're going to take a lap after practice because all the scouts are here. And we made it three quarters or one lap around the field in Hawaii, and that was kind of it for us. But, you know, that was the fun of it. And you know, I think about your college team because I was fortunate enough to play at Pitt my senior year in college, and you kind of look at this offensive line at the college level that was, you know, had NFL pedigree on there. But, you know, when you think about the way you came out and Joe Moore was able to develop you and then hand you off to Dick Stanfeld, I mean, you know, Jimbo, you're talking about two of the best offensive line coaches in the history of any level of football.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think Joe Moore, in my opinion, was one of the best offensive line coaches ever, as you just said. And Dick Stanfeld, you know, he wasn't, as you know, Tom, he wasn't the greatest technician. He was more of a, you know, repetition assignment guy. He wasn't like a Joe Moore. Joe Moore was fundamentals, fundamentals, fundamentals. Dick had a great emotion. He was able to put you in the right place. And, you know, it didn't matter how you got it done as long as you got it done. If you didn't get it done, then you had a problem with Dick. So, but I learned so much from him. And, you know, he was an even better person than he was a coach. I mean, he was a phenomenal coach, but he was even a better person. And I think that's why we all trusted him. And I think that's why we performed well with him.
Hall of Famer Jimbo Covert is with us here on 670 The Score, and I'm going to toss it back to Tom because I think one of the coolest things about the offensive line room when you guys were teammates, and I don't know, Jimbo, I'm sure you've got an imitation of Dick Stanfeld because I know that Tom does, but it's not just hearing the great stories, but hearing those stories in his voice, which I think resonate to this very day. What are some of the great memories? And Tom, you can jump in as well, that you have, because if you hear them in his voice, it's phenomenal. And there are lessons that I think carry long beyond the football field.
Well, yeah, Tom does it better than anybody, I think. But, you know, with me, it was, I remember we were playing and I was a rookie and it was a really loud stadium. It was, I think, New Orleans and the Dome and everything like that. And so, you know, you had to kind of watch a guy. And so the guy's lined up, you know, 6 yards wide. And he said, you got to watch the ball and you got to watch this. And he goes, well, Jim, what's what you got to do? You got to keep your left eye and you got to look at him out of your left eye. And then you got to watch the ball with the right eye. I go, Dick, how am I going to watch it with my left eye and my right eye? My eyes would be so far spread apart. Then you got to look back and forth, and that's how you got to do it. So he was one of a kind.
He was. You know, I can remember him being mad at all of us and telling us that we should back – you guys should back up to the pay window like Jesse James because you guys are stealing money. And then there's one time
– wear a mask and a gun when you go to work.
There was one time I was getting tossed around by somebody, and he goes, "Dub, look at yourself here. If that was me, I would be embarrassed. He's tossing you around like a dish rag. I see you in the weight room benching 500 pounds. Look at yourself here. Oh, that's embarrassing." But you know what? The development, I think that's why we developed into such a close group of guys, because nobody was exempt from getting constructive criticism. And, yeah, we looked at it differently because we were a bunch of young offensive linemen and he was an experienced coach at the time. But you think about what he was able to do and the guys that he was able to – you know, Jimbo, the unique thing about Coach Stanfeld is – you were built like you, and Horn and Keith Van Horn was built the way he was. You guys don't have a lot of similarities to you, but he was able to coach both of you to be the best, most physical athlete you could be with your body style. And that's one of the things that I really appreciated about his ability to morph everybody into what they were supposed to be.
Exactly. I mean, if you went down the line, you take Hilgi out of it because the center's a little bit different with the way they got to snap the ball. But if you look at Borchi's stance, your stance, Horn's stance, and my stance, they're all completely different, right? Completely different. He wasn't a guy that said your stance had to be this, you had to be that. As long as you got it done and you were able to get it done in a stance and how you block people and how you pass protect it, I mean, that's all he cared about. So you're exactly right. He let everybody, you know, kind of tailor make their game to what their physical attributes were, and it worked.
Hey, do you have the jacket yet, or have you seen your bust? And are you going straight hair or the old you know, teased up hair that you used to have?
I'm going with the 80s look, babe. So I got the beard going, I got a little bit of the hair going. I actually went out to Salt Lake City and spent time with Blair Buswell, who's the artist, the sculptor, and I think it made a lot of difference. When I first went in and saw, like, I don't know if that looks like me, and then spent the day with him and another half a day, and it looks pretty good. So it's in the clay now. It's ready to go to the bronzer, so I'm looking forward to seeing what it looks like.
Visiting with Hall of Famer Jimbo Covert here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. You said something really interesting earlier, that Jim McMahon is probably the brightest quarterback you ever played with, and yet you were teammates with Dan Marino. Why wasn't Marino over McMahon in terms of that department? Can you kind of take us through that next level?
Yeah, Danny was just such a physically dominating quarterback. I mean, he could throw the ball wherever he wanted to. I mean, we go out to, you know, warm-ups, just, you know, walkthroughs on Friday, and, you know, offensive line would catch balls from him, and they would whistle at you. I mean, he didn't want to catch it. He had such a great arm on him. Jim wasn't like that. You know, Jim had a flutter ball, and a lot of times, you know, it wasn't the greatest-looking pass, but it got to exactly where it needed to get to. And so physically is just completely dominant. I'm not saying that Dan, you know, didn't do things right. I mean, he's an extremely smart quarterback, but I just remember Jim, and Tom will attest to this, just being able to be in the huddle, recognize defenses, you know, put audibles out there, call audibles. And I would say 80% of the time he called an audible, it was for a big impact play, big yardage play or a touchdown. So you couldn't mess with him. You know, defenses couldn't mess with him. They couldn't disguise coverages on him because he was so smart. And he'd send guys on individual routes and do things within the offense that a lot of guys couldn't do. He understood it so well. And he only had to look at it once. He had this photographic memory, and he could just look at things. So I'm a big Jim McMahon fan. I just think that, you know, if he could have stayed healthy, we could have definitely won a couple more Super Bowls.
Jimbo, you were there during the transformation of the old Bears to the new Bears, the developing Bears, and then the Super Bowl Bears. When you look at a football team throughout those stages, what was it incrementally that, you know, was it the selection of Jimbo Covert to come in and solidify that left tackle position after years of not having it? Or what was the stages of development that caught your eye?
Well, I just think there was a lot of guys there when I got in there in 83. You were part of that class, but you went to the USFL for a couple of years. And I just think that injection of that talent, there were so many great players there already, obviously. Payton and McMahon and Horn, Hilgi, you know, and Beck was there. And then on defense with, you know, Hampton, Singletary, you know, they had McMichael, who I think is a great player. They had so many great players there. It's just that us, when we came in, we kind of stepped it up, and it was an injection of new town. And I think, you know, there was like 8 starters off of there. So, I mean, I think that 83 draft was the draft that, you know, put us over the top, and that's how we got to the Super Bowl.
I always wanted to ask Richard this about his transformation, because, you know, you kind of had a hands-on approach of the development of Richard Dent, but you also got a chance to watch him mature and bloom into the player he became. Did you recognize that, or did you feel dominant of your own ability at that point, where it was Richard catching up to you, or did you recognize that, wow, this guy's got talent to turn into something on this defense?
Well, I think we both helped each other's game, because I believe when I got there, I was probably a better run blocker than a pass blocker, even though I pass blocked, you know, at Pitt for 35, 40 times a game. I just felt I was a stronger run blocker. And Richard, you know, wasn't a great run defender when he got there. I mean, he became a great run defender. So I think I helped him in that perspective. And then he was always a great pass rusher. He had one of the best first steps I've ever seen of any defensive end. And so I had to really work hard and practice to, you know, find my pass blocking skills. And I think he had a huge hand in that. So it was a tailor-made situation where we both had some weaknesses to work on, and we both were able to get better because we played against each other in practice.
Hey, when you were picked, and obviously with Mike Ditka being a former Pitt guy, kind of a weird relationship, because it's usually the offensive line coach that, you know, you kind of gravitate towards because that's room. But Mike Ditka also had a little bit of pressure and confidence in you and on you, because, you know, you guys had a lot in common of where you played college football, but he also knew football players and the expectations he put on you. Did you feel a little bit from Ditka, or do you even still feel a little bit from Coach Ditka being a Hall of Famer himself?
No, I just felt like I had put a lot of pressure on myself, because I came in and wanted to be successful, and I knew there were a lot of expectations, big expectations for a first-round draft pick, picking the 6th pick to come in and play right away. And I wanted to make sure that I was the guy to do that. I didn't want to disappoint anybody, but most importantly, I didn't want to disappoint myself. So, you know, I worked really hard at it and tried to become prepared, and, you know, worked out hard in the weight room and did the strength training and did the things I needed to do to be successful. And then playing against our defensive line every day in practice, you know, just upped everybody's game and just, you know, I thought made me a much better player. So I think it was just a combination of a lot of things. And then, you know, like I said, when you're practicing against the best, you become a heck of a lot better.
85 Bear Jimbo Covert, who is headed for the Hall of Fame, is our guest here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. I sent Tom an article this morning where Dante Scarnecchia gave an interview talking about the traits that he looks for in his offensive linemen. And number one, he said they have to be tough, and not just mentally tough, but just physically tough. And then he said you cannot play on the offensive line if you're not smart. And then, especially at the position you played, you have to be athletic enough to be able to handle the pass rushers that are coming your way. What do you think your strength was?
I just felt like, you know, I played the left tackle position in high school. I obviously wasn't the same type of importance. It was, but it wasn't really looked like that. I when I got to Pitt, I played the left tackle position, and, you know, I got coached by Joe Moore, who I think was the best. And so when I got there, that was probably one of the only positions I could play, because I played it for so long. So if they would have stuck me at right tackle or even guard, maybe I wouldn't have been able to do the things I did. So I just thought I was tailor-made. I thought I had a different kind of body than most left tackles. They were a little bit taller and lankier. So I had to work on my footwork, because I didn't think I had the greatest footwork when I got there, and I really had to work on it. So especially guys on turf and guys lining up real wide that can, you know, turn the corner on you.
So I just feel like I had things to work on. But you're right. I mean, if you're not tough, I mean, if you look at all of the guys I played with, you know, the five of us and, you know, the backups and guys like that, I mean, they were all tough guys and all smart guys. And you're exactly right. You got to be smart. Because your assignment can change in a millisecond on the line, and all the calls that we had, and you know, I knew what everybody else was doing, they knew what I was doing, and that just made for a great relationship. And we trusted each other too, and that was a big thing. We used to, you know, chop on each other and dig on each other and throw digs at each other, but it was like a family doing it with a family, and I think that just, you know, we were probably the tightest unit on the football team.
You know, the weird thing about football, and that was a great article by the ex-offensive line coach of New England Patriots. He's got a lot of things right about the traits he looks for in offensive line. But you know, Jimbo, which kind of upsets me about the modern-day evaluation of players, and every year they want to evaluate the best left tackle coming out in the draft. He's got 37-inch arms, and he's this weight and that weight. And I always say, I don't care if you put Jimbo Covert in the draft of any era you want to go to, he's not going to measure up to the template that they have of these modern-day left tackles, but Jimbo Covert would be the best left tackle coming out of the draft. Sometimes, Jimbo, it's kind of frustrating to me when outside observers, they look at the size and not, like you said, matching the feet with the hands, the aggressive ability to run block, the intelligence to play the position, and that's what you were bred to play. I don't know how you look at it if you pay attention to it very much anymore, but just this whole idea that you got to be a certain size and shape to play the position, that's unfair to guys like yourself, that have become Hall of Famers.
Yeah, I think they take a lot. I mean, I think scouts and people that, evaluate talent, look at some traits that they're looking for, especially a left tackle. I mean, you're looking at guys that have these, like, 39, 40-inch sleeve lengths and reach and, have great feet and, can do all these different things. But, they got to be tough, and if they're not tough kids, they're not going to be able to play at that level, right? And so that's number one. And number two, I just like to look at a guy on film. I mean, I'd rather see a guy on film and how he plays against good competition. And if he dominates against good competition, then that's the kind of player you want. Or you don't want a guy just because he looks good on a stat sheet and says that he can do this and run a 4.5 or 4.8 40 and bench press 500 pounds. I mean, I really don't care about all that stuff. I want to see what he looks like on film.
All right, on the way out here, Jimbo, have you already written the speech? And if you have, are you going to tweak it by next year?
I haven't written the speech yet. I started a little bit of it, but then, I was waiting to see what happened because they were talking about August and September and then combining it in September. And then it was just so much uncertainty. I just said, I'm going to wait till they finalize it. And once they finalize it, I'll start on it. So, and then I think it's going to be what it's going to look like next year is the class of 2020 is going to go on Saturday and the class of 2021 is going to go on Sunday. So it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a huge celebration. And I think maybe we will have a little bit more time than they generally thought. They thought we were just going to have 5 or 6 minutes to give a speech. So I think they're going to give us maybe 10 or 15. So it'll be a lot of fun to see what that, what that's going to look like.
Wait to be there for you, Jimbo, in support, because I think you're a great representation of what I think is one of the best offensive lines in the history of the NFL. And, we are proud of you. We appreciate you. We thank you for coming on, taking some time, and you will be the first Hall of Fame speech that I ever go to in person because I can't wait to see you up there. And remember, T-H-A-Y-E-R. That's how you spell it.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. thanks, Tommy. Those words mean a lot to me. I appreciate that, and it was great chatting with you guys.
Thanks, Jimbo.
Jimbo Covert, who will be entering the Hall of Fame next year officially, inducted, was supposed to be part of the 2020 inductions, but obviously we are living in a unique time, so everything postponed until 2021. Hopefully, as Jimbo said, it can be a true celebration where we can have a huge gathering again, and everyone can go there and just celebrate and not have to worry about potentially catching the virus, which is the reason that it's been canceled this year. What a great guy. We could talk to Jimbo for another hour about football, and it just shows the group that you guys had, Tom, very, very special back in the day.
Yeah, it is. And like I said, Jimbo's a great representation of the offensive line. And as a Chicago Bear, you know, I'll be proud to see him walk around in his yellow jacket and look at his bust.
Very cool. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, baseball right here on The Score.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.